Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the meltdown on Wall Street and the extent to which the citizens of this country are expected to bail out the profligacy of others. We'll talk with two economists, beginning in a moment with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project, and he serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. He writes a column called Econoclast for Mother Jones and occasional commentary for other publications, including the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and The Nation magazine. His new book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. He'll be followed by Robert Kuttner, founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, a Boston Globe columnist, TV and radio commentator, and he wrote a column for Business Week for 20 years. He's got a new book out called Obama's Challenge, and we're talking to both those economists. And then we'll talk with Dr. Philip Butler, who is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He served as a light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam and spent over 8 years as a POW, compared, of course, to John McCain's 5.5 years. He knew John McCain both at Annapolis and throughout that period during the Vietnam War, and he believes that John McCain is unfit to be president of the United States, so he will make his case as a fellow POW, why he thinks being a former POW is not necessarily a qualification to be president of the United States. And then we'll talk with Nate Silver, who is the main force behind the polling analysis website 538.com, which has become the go-to political information source, been cited for its accuracy in its commentary and predictions by Chuck Todd of MSNBC and others. His principal occupation has been as a writer, analyst, and partner in a sports media company called Baseball Prospectus, and he sees a similarity between politics and sports analysis. His website has been named after the number of electors in the Electoral College, spelled out 538, not the figures, but the word 538.com. I'm now speaking with James Galbraith. Dr. James Galbraith teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project there and serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. He writes a column called Econoclast for Mother Jones and occasional commentary for many other publications, including the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and The Nation. His new book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Do So. And I must say, just harking back to the Founding Fathers and the Puritans and the people who founded this country, in many ways, I wish they'd bring back the stocks and put some of these culprits who've looted America put the stocks on Wall Street and put them on display. I know that's a fanciful notion, but isn't this an outrage, what's happened to the American people at the hands of a handful of people?
Well, it's not at all a fanciful notion. In the aftermath of the savings and loan crisis, more than 1,000 people were convicted of federal felonies, and that process of investigation and prosecution is going to have to be part of the cleanup of this latest financial debacle, because a great many of the mortgages on which this whole house of cards of mortgage-backed securities was built were, in fact, abusively and fraudulently made in the first place, particularly on the basis of inflated appraisals. The whole system was structured so as to reward abusive and predatory players. That's very clear.
But wasn't it also a vast transfer of wealth from largely minority people aspiring to join the middle class who were given these trick-or-treat loans, and then the people who gave them the loans, the brokers, all ran off with a ton of money, and now the whole house of cards is crumbling down. And then but the same beleaguered taxpayer has to pick up the tab. So isn't this rather like double jeopardy?
Well, it is double. I don't know how many jeopardies there are, but there are certainly many jeopardies involved. What happened here was that the originators made, of course, fees, and then they sold the loans downstream to banks and investment banks, who packaged them and sold them on to pension funds on other investors, with the thought that when they did blow up, that somebody else would be left holding the bag. So yes, there's multiple jeopardy, but we do have to remember that when the if we ever forced all of these assets to be liquidated, it would affect portfolios of all of us. I mean, everybody is in this to some degree, just as the foreclosure crisis affects the value not only of the homes of people who were foreclosed, but all of their neighbors.
Well, you this week, the administration asked Congress to raise the U.S. national debt limit to $11.3 trillion. And if you divide that figure by the 138 million U.S. taxpayers, that means that every taxpayer's share of the national debt will be $81,884.06. I imagine everybody listening would like to actually have that money rather than owe that money.
Well, I'm not going to get into this discussion about the national debt. It's a red herring, frankly.
Uh-huh.
What the administration asked for was be able to spend $700 billion to buy up mortgage-backed securities in order to get those assets off of the balance sheet. Something is going to be enacted possibly this week. The issue before us now is what terms and conditions will be in that bill to protect the public interest. In the draft that the Treasury sent over to the Congress, there's essentially nothing. It's a complete blank check. Congress is not, I think, going to enact a blank check. So now the question is, what conditions should be imposed? And that's the issue we should be focusing on.
Well, indeed. But in terms of politics, the administration and Paulson and Bernanke are acting like they're holding a gun to the Congress's head. It should be the other way around. The Congress should be the ones that are exercising the as representatives of the people, what should happen with all of this money and who it should be bailing out, whether it's going to bail out people on Wall Street or people on Main Street.
Well, the Treasury is going to be the executing agency of any scheme that is enacted. Congress does, in fact, have the whip hand at the moment, because it is not in the administration's interest to permit a complete financial meltdown. The administration will have to accept the terms that Congress asks it to agree to. The question now before the Congress is whether it can settle on terms that will in fact be effective in protecting the public interest, and whether it can do so quickly. That's the real issue.
But
so it really is a challenge for the Congress right now. It's an amazingly important week.
And Dr. James Galbraith, you said that the extent of the national debt and how much it can be applied to each individual's alleged liability, that it's a red herring. But what about just doing some of the numbers? There's a $9 trillion credit card debt. I think there's something...
It's easy to terrify yeah. everybody with these big numbers. But in a $15 trillion GDP, the U.S. The important point is that the United States government is not bankrupt. We have a problem here in the private sector that was created by abusive practices in the mortgage origination industry, aided and abetted by Wall Street. Dealing with that problem is well within the capacity of the United States. The United States is not going to go bankrupt over this. Mm-hmm. What we have to make sure, however, is that this is done in a way which puts the financial sector back on a basis which permits it to function in the national interest on a sustainable basis going forward. That problem simply has not been addressed, and it probably won't be addressed in full until we have a new administration that's actually committed to doing something along those lines. And that's obviously going to happen. If it happens, it'll happen in January.
Well, just in closing, Dr. James Galbraith, what we know about, in fact, they asked for $700 billion on Friday, but on Thursday, $300 billion was pumped into, $100 billion into the U.S. and the rest abroad. I don't know whether you have to add those two numbers together. But at the end of the day, when you're trying to figure out what these liabilities are, because there was very little collateral backing them, and we know that's why AIG had to be bailed out, because they were issuing insurance against these swaps that nobody knows.
The problem here is not that there's no collateral. The problem is that there are these mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, which the market cannot value. They're too complicated. The whole thing is an enormous mess. Nobody really trusts any of the market valuations. It's not as though these things are going to be defaulted at 100% rate. That's not the case. The private markets are in a gridlock because of a complete collapse of trust, which is a collapse of the regulatory framework, which is the responsibility and the fault of the Bush administration. So the question going forward is, do you have an administration that is committed to rebuilding an effective regulatory framework, or an administration which follows the rhetoric of deregulation and of not having the government involved? The second course, if the voters choose it in November, will in fact lead to a sustained disaster. There's just absolutely no doubt about that.
And so are we not to therefore worry about the derivatives, which have grown from 100 trillion 5 years ago to 500 trillion in 2007?
The derivative instruments, the credit default swaps, are in fact the problem here. These are over-the-counter instruments that have no market valuation. Establishing what they're worth, again, they're not worth nothing, but establishing what they're worth that could make them, you know, traded and essentially help make it possible to clean up balance sheets is the huge challenge. This is like cutting the Gordian knot, or, you know, you can come up with your own metaphor. This is a very, very difficult problem.
I thank you so much for clearing up some of this stuff here today in Los Angeles, Dr. James Galbraith.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project and serves as the chairman of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. He writes a column called Econoclast for Mother Jones and occasional commentary for other publications, the Texas Observer, American Prospect, and The Nation, among them. His new book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Let's now go to a second economist, Robert Kuttner. I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's a founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's a Boston Globe columnist, a radio and television commentator, and a contributor to many magazines. He wrote a column for Business Week for 20 years, and his books include Everything for Sale and The End of Laissez-Faire and The Squandering of America. His latest book is Obama's Challenge. And it is a bit surreal, Robert Kuttner, that the man who was on the banking committee, the chair of the banking committee, throughout the time when this disaster on Wall Street with the U.S. economy was incubating, somehow John McCain has turned it around and blamed it all on Barack Obama.
Well, it was, just to be accurate, he was chairman of the Commerce Committee, which is a close cousin. But, of course, he was deeply implicated in the savings and loan scandal in the late 1980s. I don't think it's sticking. I mean, there was the ad that the McCain campaign put out falsely tying Obama to Frank Raines, whose main value to the McCain campaign, I think, is the fact that he's black. So you could put Obama on an ad with another black man who was partly responsible for the mess at Fannie Mae. But, of course, Obama has nothing whatever to do with Frank Raines. I don't think it's sticking, and I'll tell you why. I think Republicans are all over the lot on this, and if your listeners looked at any of the Sunday talk shows this morning, they heard Senator Richard Shelby say that he had real problems with the Paulson plan. Shelby's the ranking Republican on the Senate Banking Committee. Shelby flatly blamed the crisis on greed, his word, and regulatory failures, his word. There are other Republicans who are more libertarian, who don't think the government has any business bailing out failed business decisions. And to me, what's most interesting is the fact that the Democrats have a lot of cards here. They do not have to simply take whatever Paulson offers them. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how tough the Democrats are going to be. I had a senior Democrat say to me, they have a gun to our heads. And I think it's actually the reverse. It's Wall Street and Paulson who desperately need the collaboration of Congress. And so the question is whether Congress will hang tough on the terms of the bailout. And if you like, I can tick off what I think those terms ought to be.
Well, let's just stay with the politics of who's to blame. Isn't it pretty clear that the co-chair of McCain's committee, and up until recently his chief economic advisor, is probably of all the individuals that you could point a finger at in this collective catastrophe, he would be probably the most culpable. I'm talking about Phil Gramm, who slipped in the Enron loophole and created all these dark markets.
And not only that, but prevented the Securities and Exchange Commission from doing its job. He's the lead sponsor of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which was the act that repealed the cornerstone of New Deal financial regulation that had prevented all this stuff, the Glass-Steagall Act. And then, of course, his other guru is Carly Fiorina, who walked away from a failed company with a golden parachute, I think, of $45 or $50 million. So McCain has absolutely no credibility, and the only question is whether the Obama campaign and the Democrats in general will be as effective as they can be in hanging this around his neck where it richly deserves to be hung.
Well, that's my next question. Why haven't they done it? I mean, the ammunition's there.
I think in the last 48 hours, and I have been one of, I wrote this book, Obama's Challenge, on how Obama could be the next Roosevelt. And I've been, as someone who thinks this is potentially a great man, I've been very critical of him in the past 10 days for letting, you know, Sarah Palin can shoot a moose and all of this stupid stuff create advantage in the polls for the Republicans. I think in the last couple of days he's gotten his voice back. I don't know whether he's changed speechwriters or whether he's just speaking from his own heart, but he seems to be liberated to say what needs to be said, and he's said, you know, some wonderful things. That great line about McCain wants to fire the head of the SEC, Chris Cox. Well, folks, on November 4th, you can fire them all. And lines like that, he has been more aggressive in taking it to McCain. And this from a guy who really wanted to be somewhat post-partisan, post-ideological. Well, you can't be post-partisan on an eve of an election when one party stands for the kind of deregulation that created this mess, and the other party stands for a more managed version of capitalism, which would have headed off this entire crisis. So I think he's doing what he needs to do. I hope he does it even more eloquently and effectively, but I would give him an A-minus the last couple of days.
What about, though, a macroeconomic picture being put out there to let the American people know how much they've been hosed? I mean, wages have been flat since Reagan. The Fed has been lending banks money for over a decade now, as low as 2%. They've been charging that money back to people with credit cards up to 20% and more.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about wages being low, credit being made available, people getting incredibly in debt, and that's the only way they maintain their standard of living vis-a-vis the rest of the Western countries.
Well, it's the only way the United States has maintained its capital markets by doing the same thing that individuals have had to do, namely going hat in hand to the Chinese and the Japanese and the Saudis to borrow money that substitutes for exports that we no longer make, because instead of exporting products, we're exporting jobs. So sure, there's a tremendous potent story that needs to be told. I think the campaign could tell it in a stronger voice. You're right.
And an adjunct to that is this idea that you know, Pickens has got an ad out now talking about this vast transfer of wealth to Saudi Arabia and the oil producers. But there's been a vast transfer of wealth that's taken place in the last few years where aspiring minority homeowners got into the market, largely got conned, but they were trying to get into the middle class. All that money they put up went straight into the hands of these pirates on Wall Street, who then ran off with all this money, left the taxpayer holding the bag, to the point of what $1 trillion has gone out the door in the last couple of days. So it strikes me as double jeopardy there.
Absolutely, no question about it. And I think the reason I want to spend a couple of minutes of your listeners' time talking about the Paulson package is I think if the Democrats do their job and insist as a condition of this authority that we give some help to Main Street as well as to Wall Street, it not only would deliver tangible help, but it would also draw a very useful distinction between the way Republicans and McCain want to deal with this crisis and the way Roosevelt would have dealt with this crisis, or the way McCain, I hope, deals with this crisis. I mean, we need not just to give Paulson a blank check. I mean, this is the analog of the Iraq War. You know, it's no oversight. It's there's a provision in there that says no judicial review. Just give us $700 billion of either debt or taxpayer money and let us use it as we see fit. And, you know, if you don't do this, Congress, well, something terrible might happen. And I think Congress needs to call his bluff and say the only way we're going to do this is, number one, there's going to have to be some accountability here. You can't just do this out of your hip pocket the way you've been doing it. Secondly, the government needs to take an equity stake in companies that get these bailouts. Thirdly, there have to be limits on executive compensation so that the CEOs that are getting all this benefit from the government can't just take, as Barney Frank said this morning, you know, tens of millions more on their way out the door. And I also think it needs to be tied to two other things: a much stronger stimulus package. I mean, if we can use $700 billion to bail out Wall Street, cities and towns and states and public infrastructure Medicare matches and all kinds of public needs are going unmet. The Bush administration has taken the position that the cupboard is bare. We can't possibly find the money to help ordinary people, families, cities, towns. And now all of a sudden they found $700 billion to help Wall Street. And the last thing that should be the quid pro quo is it should be tied to refinancing for anybody who got conned by the subprime scam. It shouldn't just be the middlemen who get bailed out. It should be these homeowners that you mentioned. So I think Congress has the leverage to say, Mr. Paulson, if we're going to go along with this, you have to do some things for Main Street as well as Wall Street.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Kuttner, and for outlining some of the points which certainly the Democrats should be picking up on, because they say, as Carvel used to say, it's the economy, stupid.
Well, and it would be terrific politics. You know, it would remind voters just what the Republican right stands for and just what kind of a guy Hank Paulson really is and whose interests he's serving. He's still behaving as if he were at Goldman Sachs, where he came from, and he just happens to have this blank line of credit from the Treasury that he wants, but it's to help his Wall Street chums. It's not to help the American people, and there is no more important lesson to be drawn 40 days before the election.
I thank you very much for joining
us. Thank
you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Master. So just speaking then with Robert Kuttner, who's the founder, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's a Boston Globe columnist, a radio and TV commentator, and he contributed to many magazines. He wrote a column for Business Week for 20 years. His books include Everything for Sale and The End of Laissez-Faire and The Squandering of America. His latest book is Obama's Challenge. I'm now speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legion of Merits, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Heart Medals. After his repatriation in 1973, he earned a PhD in sociology from the University of California at San Diego and became a Navy organizational effectiveness consultant. He completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Phil Butler then founded Camelot Enterprises, a management seminar professional speaking consulting services business. As a professional keynote speaker, he told his dramatic and inspiring story of how POWs were able to survive and succeed. Today, Philip Butler serves as a trustee of the Big Sur Land Trust, a docent at the Point Lobos State Reserve, and is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. And, of course, you have an article out on military.com, Dr. Philip Butler, Why I Won't Vote for John McCain. Can you give us a brief summary of why you won't vote for John McCain?
Well, good morning, Ian, and thanks for having me on your show. I think the article was vindicated just 2 days ago when the news came out of the economic crisis, and we got to see in juxtaposition Barack Obama and John McCain. And it was incredible the way John McCain reacted, like he typically does, with anger, you know, getting red in the face, saying who he was going to fire and whose fault it was. And then a bit later, he blamed Barack Obama for the crisis, and it got pretty ridiculous. And at the same time, Barack Obama was giving a very reasoned and level speech about he and his advisors wanted to give our government time to react before he had presented his plan, and just the difference in temperament was unbelievable. And that's one of the things that I talked about in my article, was that knowing him as a midshipman at the Naval Academy, he was a wild and bully guy then, but he had a vicious temper then, quite a strong temper, and he reacts to things pugnaciously, and you can just see him doing it 2 days ago. You know, the guy that's 72 is not any different from the guy who was 20.
Well, you also in your article say most of us who survived the POW experience are now in our late 60s and 70s. Sadly, we have died and are dying off at a greater rate than our non-POW contemporaries. We experienced injuries and malnutrition that are coming home to roost. So I believe John's age, 72, and survival expectations are not good for being elected to serve as our president for 4 years or more. And you know what the subtext there, Dr. Phil Butler, is of course, Sarah Palin.
Yes, that's a frightening thought, isn't it? You know, it's a very frightening thought that Sarah Palin, who was selected by John McCain for political reasons, so he could win an election, while on the other hand, Barack Obama was elected by a whole lot of people to help our country. And you know, this business McCain's always talking about country over politics, and just his selection of Sarah Palin is enough to make a lie of that statement, because clearly and purely, you know, he selected her as a political ploy to try to get himself elected. And it is dangerous, because it is true that those of us who experienced the prisoner of war experience for as many years as John did, as many as I did, do have physical problems that others in comparison group do not have. And this has been well documented in a continuing health study that's being done in Pensacola, Florida, the Danville Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, on returned POWs and the comparison group of people. So, you know, I am 2 years younger than John, 70, and have to confess to having problems. Don't know how much longer I might survive. I'm 100% disabled veteran. And so, you know, I know that John also has kept a lid on his health reports. It was a sort of a ludicrous example, I think, about a year or so ago, where he let a bunch of reporters in, but he wouldn't let them bring their computers or their BlackBerries.
Right. They had stacks and stacks of thousands of pages of documents. They had an hour, beat the clock type of situation. Also, Dr. Phil Butler, you have to add to that. I mean, actuarial tables give John McCain one in six chances of not living out the next 2 years, and then you have to add to that four bouts of melanoma, and also his father died at age 70, and his grandfather died at age 61.
Wow, those are wonderful examples and statistics that you have there, numbers and things that I wasn't aware of. You know, I was purely coming at it from point of view of how we former prisoners of war have been hanging in there and surviving or not surviving, and I had no idea that stuff that you just named off sheds an incredible light on this and really makes it even more frightening when you see Sarah Palin up there telling us how she can see Russia from Alaska.
And she's ready for the mission.
She's ready, yeah. She never blinked.
We haven't heard that before. But and you, of course, were in a POW in North Vietnam for 8 years. John McCain came 2.5 years later. and was in there for 5.5 years. I don't know whether, Dr. Phil Butler, that you are aware of this new investigative piece by Sidney Shanberg, the New York Times reporter who wrote about the killing fields in Cambodia.
Oh, I really respect that guy, but I'm not aware of the latest thing he's done.
It's titled, it's out, actually it's in The Nation magazine in the current issue. It's called McCain and the POW Cover-Up. And he looks into why John McCain has been so, has used his position on the United States Senate to thwart any investigations into the POW-MIA situation, which you know is the basis of Rambo and all of this other stuff. And it's pervasive belief on the part of many people that not all the POWs got out. This article indicates that that Eugene Tai, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, felt that there were a lot of POWs who were left behind. He and McCain bitterly clashed. But the long and the short of it is there is some evidence that surfaced in Russia, where a Politburo member from North Vietnam admitted that there were, I think, about 12, they were holding about 1,200 POWs, and you were released along with John McCain. I think, 500 and something were released, were they not?
I think 660 military, although a total of a grand total of 801 were released, but 660 military, and the rest being civilians of various sorts, doctors, nurses, foreign nationals. We had Thai pilots, a couple of those, and we had a South Vietnamese pilot, and assortment of CIA folks and what have you, 801 total, but 660 U.S. military.
Well, the theory is here that in this article, it's well worth taking a look at and checking out. The idea, I guess, that Sidney Shanberg's putting forth here is that he believes that John McCain's played an active role in keeping this under wraps, that apparently, the motive on the part of the Vietnamese for holding back and not releasing all of the POWs was that they were expecting reparations money that that Nixon had promised and then that hadn't delivered on, and that essentially, once that sort of led its course, they both sides had no great motive in wanting to discuss or talk about what happened to the fate of these people. They became a kind of embarrassment. I mean, it does feed into that kind of Rambo myth. I thought that had been pretty well dismissed, but this is a pretty credible journalist, and his information seems pretty credible.
I'll have to check that out, Ian. I'll have to confess that I've pretty much taken a bye on all that stuff because of all the speculation involved in it, and I've always pretty much also felt, too, that that there probably are not any missing in action there, and that, by and large, you'll recall some, 10 or 15 years ago, I guess, the deal was that there was a group of right-wingers that were playing up the Vietnam MIAs partly in order to keep us from establishing diplomatic relations with Vietnam, and that was thwarted by Senators John Kerry and John McCain, who had made many trips, both of them, to Vietnam, and actually a former prisoner of war friend of mine, Pete Peterson, became the first ambassador to Vietnam. Right. So the right was really heavy on punishing
Vietnam. And it was also a kind of a cottage industry for those people, too.
Exactly. It was that, too. Yes, sir, it certainly was. Here's another thing that entered my thoughts. It has ever since I've come home, and that has been such a brouhaha made over MIAs from the Vietnam War. And at one time they were citing 2,000, and then this number has dropped down into the teens or 20s. But we must understand, first of all, that there are 8,000 missing in action from the Korean War, and 45,000 or more missing from World War II. So why focus on, the few from Vietnam? And then, on the other hand, here's another focal point that is, to me, is really powerful, and I don't think the American people give this enough consideration, that don't take this into their hearts, and that is The Vietnamese people have over 300,000 missing in action because when we B-52 carpet bombed, we plowed bodies into trenches and covered them back up. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but the Vietnamese people, during the time that we were at war with them, had more than 2 million people killed, most of whom, of course, were civilians. So that I think those things, bring a certain perspective that hasn't come out in the American press. And, of course, the overall perspective is that war really stinks. It's really a stupid and disgusting endeavor that countries get themselves into and that people pay the price for.
But, Dr. Philip Butler, John McCain, and in fact, I wonder why the Democrats haven't cut together a commercial. And so many clips on the stump, I've seen him saying, my friends, we're going to have more wars. My friends, I know how to win wars. Continually referring to war and his ability as a warrior and his readiness as a warrior and his prediction or belief that we are almost in a cycle of endless wars, and that's why you have to vote for him.
Yeah, no, he just said it the other day when he got confused about where Spain was, whether it was in Latin America or, in Asia or wherever the heck Spain was. But, he said, the interviewer said, well, would you speak with Spain? He says, well, yes, in my government, we'll speak to our friends, but we definitely, our enemies will pay the price. So what kind of diplomacy is that where you draw a line in the sand and say you're not going to speak to anybody but the nations that are your friends? I mean, that's the kind of bellicose, and pugnacious thinking that is in John McCain's head. His response is war, it's fight. That's his response and his answer to almost any sort of a disagreement or confrontation.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Phil, in your article, again, available at military.com, Why I Won't Vote for John McCain, you talk about being a POW is no special qualification for being President of the United States, and also your concern that with his infamous hot-headed temper, that you wouldn't want his finger next to the button.
Well, absolutely. I don't think that just because we were POWs in Vietnam or Korea or World War II or Iraq or any other place, I don't think that that necessarily makes somebody a qualification for being president of the United States or having served in combat or having been wounded in combat or whatever. There's a lot more in my mind to being president of the United States. It certainly is a qualification that is far, far above my pay grade. I know that for sure. One of my biggest concerns about John is his temperament, his anger and his temperament, and it carries on to this very day. In fact, in the September 22nd Newsweek, there's a wonderful article in there about Jonathan Alter, by Jonathan Alter, and he talks about McCain's anger, and he says that he, Jonathan Alter, spoke with four senators and two former senators who attested to John McCain's blow-ups in the Senate. And Senator Thad Cochran, in January of 08, who's a Republican, said this, I quote, about McCain, "He is erratic, he is hot-headed, he loses his temper, and he worries me. The thought of his being president sends a cold chill down my spine." That's a Republican senator talking about John McCain.
Well, I've spoken to Senate staffers who witnessed him have tantrums and tirades and knock papers off the desk and kick chairs over in committee meetings. So
yeah, it's
pretty bizarre. But, they're doing a wonderful job of essentially keeping Sarah Palin in a bubble and keeping him, he's out on the campaign. He's quite aggressive. And conversely, I wonder about the other side being passive, although I guess things are breaking for them in terms of the economy. I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Dr. Phil Butler, but thank you so much for joining us, and we'll stay in touch.
And I
understand you're on a lot of – you're now made yourself available for attacks from the right wing. So
I have, yes, indeed. That's part of the game, isn't it?
Okay.
I imagine you've been in for a few attacks yourself, Ian.
I think so. I think
I want to thank you for what you're doing to shed light on the issues.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again. I was just speaking then with Dr. Philip Butler, 1961 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. A highly decorated combat veteran, he was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he has since become stayed with the United States Navy in organizational effectiveness consultant, retired as a commander. And he feels John McCain, who he knows from going back to their days together at the academy through the POW experience, that John McCain is not fit to be president of the United States, and he won't vote for him. You can read his essay at military.com. I'm now speaking with Nate Silver, who is the main force behind the polling analysis website 538.com. That's spelt out, not in numbers, but in letters, 538.com, which has become the go-to political information source and has been cited for its accuracy in its commentary and predictions by Chuck Todd and others. Its principal principal occupation of Nate Silver as a writer, analyst, and partner was at a sports media company called Baseball Prospectus, and he sees similarities between politics and sports analysis. His website is named after the number of electors in the Electoral College, and it's of course spelled out at www.538.com. And one of the things that I'm just a little puzzled by, Nate Silver, that seems to be happening now is that the polls indicate that Barack Obama's had a bounce because of the disaster on Wall Street, continuing disaster on Wall Street, I should say, and he's up 6 points in some states and more in others. Yet at the same time, correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that McCain is gaining more electoral college seats. So there's a disconnect here, isn't there?
Well, there is, and part of it is because of the timing of the polling, where, you know, we have 4 or 5 national tracking polls released every day. That's the Gallup numbers that people look at. But the state poll sometimes might be released. You might have a Sunday newspaper releasing a state poll that was conducted. Usually that wouldn't matter, but in a time like right now where the polls have moved things 4 or 5 points toward Obama over the span of about a week because of the Wall Street crisis, you might have the state data slow to catch up. So, but I mean, you have to assume that if he's gained 4 or 5 points nationally versus where he was last week, he has to gain that somewhere. We might know it might be in the South, it might be in the Midwest. We don't know for sure, but we know that somewhere on that map he's going to be improving.
So in terms of the Electoral College, which many people think is arcane and antiquated and could be easily abolished, how is the Obama strategy measuring up? Because if you look back to 2004, John Kerry only lost because he lost in Ohio, and there's a lot of evidence that there was considerable voter suppression there. But of course, paradoxically, had he won, he would have been 3.5 million behind in the popular vote, having won the presidency through the Electoral College. And, of course, we all know what happened in 2000, where Bush was 560,000 behind in the popular vote and yet won the Electoral College by 527 votes.
Well, I think the Obama campaign doesn't want to wake up on, you know, November 4th and have someone say the election's going to come down to Ohio or Florida. I think those two states that Democrats have gambled on before and lost, of course, they still have very robust organizations in those states, but they want to put states like Colorado into play, like Virginia, like Indiana, which I think they're very serious about, maybe like North Carolina, where the McCain campaign just put more offices in and where Obama's campaigning today. So I think if they have to win Ohio, they'll try their best. They have a good ground game there, but they want to expand the map, maybe not as much as before Sarah Palin, where they thought, well, we'll put Alaska into play, North Dakota and Georgia. You know, that's not going to happen anymore. But they do 4 or 5 targets, a lot of different kind of lottery tickets, I think they feel like, November 4th.
Well, you mentioned Indiana, because Evan Bayh was one of, on the list for VPs, and that state, perhaps he would have helped in that state. The last I saw on that was that McCain was, I think, 6 points ahead. Correct me again. But one of the things that's interesting about that state is that I think there's only 3 million voters or something, but there's an influx of 500,000 new registered voters. So give us a sense of what's going on under the radar here with the number of new registrants, many of whom we believe are young, and also we also understand that pollsters don't necessarily have access to these young potential voters, many of whom have gravitated to Barack Obama because they use cell phones, and cell phones are not a part of the mix, apparently.
Sure. I mean, you know, with Indiana first, Indiana has always had, recently had one of the lowest turnout rates in the country, and that's unusual. Usually voters in the Midwest turn out in, you know, quite strong numbers, and it might be because there hasn't really been a campaign there in many years, ever since Dan Quayle got the VP nomination for the Republicans in 1988. You know, the state was kind of off limits. The Democrats lost ground there, didn't have any reason to kind of make it a swing state. But Obama sort of was forced to target it during the primaries and has kept his organization intact ever since. And now it's polling at, you know, I think 2 or 3 points in the kind of public polling averages for McCain. The Obama campaign might tell you they had a poster if you looked at their numbers. But, you know, they feel like, yeah, this is a state where there are a lot of unregistered voters. There are, you know, these students at Notre Dame and IU. And, you know, you have Purdue, you have 3 or 4 big universities. They have Indianapolis, where there's a big African-American turnout, and they have the northwest part of the state, which borders Chicago. So they feel like they have 3 handles onto the state. They, you know, these phones that you mentioned, there are a lot of young voters in Indiana. Most pollsters will not call cell phones. Pollsters that do have had better numbers for Obama by 2 or 3 points overall. So their map and their, you know, kind of strategy room in Chicago probably looks different than the public polling because they do include cell phones. They do have different assumptions about what turnout is going to look like.
Well, I mean, I know that you just stick to analysis, Nate Silver, at your website, 538.com, although you did mention that you thought that McCain was running a more creative campaign than Obama, and I would certainly have no argument with that. But given the external situation, particularly with this meltdown on Wall Street, which reminds you of the adage by James Carville, it's the economy, stupid. I would have thought, and with the gaffes on the campaign that McCain seems to regularly display, that Obama would be way ahead. And one of the factors that suggests that one of the reasons why he's not so far ahead is that there's a kind of hidden component of racism here. So is there any way of quantifying that, if
well,
indeed it's,
you know,
true?
The Associated Press had a speech out yesterday they did with, on behalf of Stanford University, I think, that said it might be a 6-point gap because of the race factor. Now, I've looked at that study a little bit. I think the numbers are probably smaller. I think there are people who vote against Obama's race. I think in a couple other ways, you know, his race is helpful in terms of to build his story, his narrative, making him seem like a change agent. But there's no doubt that it's an obstacle that, you know, most Democratic nominees wouldn't have to overcome. I think it might be more concentrated in places like the South that Democrats probably don't need quite as much. But they also feel like, you know, hey, if we turn out the African-American vote, and black voters do turn out in pretty big numbers, there's not a big gap, but they think they can have that vote overperform for them, you know, actually turn out at heavier rates than the white vote. And if that's the case, then states like, you know, Michigan, where we have one of the largest African-Americans outside the Midwest, or these kind of border states like Virginia and North Carolina, which are kind of becoming more northern and always have had a large African-American population, it does put states in play for them that maybe, you know, maybe a Hillary Clinton wouldn't have had. She might have won West Virginia, and Kentucky would probably have it going easier, I think, in Ohio and Florida. But the Obama campaign thinks it you know, it is helpful to have the black vote turn out for them in a couple of these states kind of along the southern coast.
So just to kind of get a big picture here, Nate Silver again, the main force behind the polling analysis website, 538.com, which is the number of electors in the Electoral College. It's always been understood that the Electoral College was created by the Founding Fathers as a way to give the small rural states a bit of a leg up so that the electorate wouldn't be dominated by the urban centers, particularly on the East Coast then. There was no West Coast back then, obviously. But it does seem to be that the red and the blue is essentially on the coasts and the rest is in the middle and in the south. Is there an inherent advantage for Republicans in the Electoral College?
Well, we think this year it actually helps the Democrats. And one reason why is that the number of electoral votes based on the census that was conducted in 2000. Since 2000 and you know, between then and now, there's been migration into Texas, into Florida, into Arizona, you know, states that you vote Republican. If you reallocate the electors today, Texas would have four more electoral votes, and it would take those from states like Massachusetts and New York, which are losing population relative to the rest of the country. So if you actually did the Electoral College based on what population is today, what it was 8 years ago, some of these scenarios that work for Obama now would become losing scenarios for him. So, you know, that's one reason why, you know, just the kind of the population flow is a factor, but also the fact that, you know, this is where his kind of, you know, 50-state campaign, well, he never was in 50 states, but he was in 20 or so. This is where it helps him because he does have a lot of different options. You know, he can lose the popular vote and still win the carry states plus Colorado, Iowa, New Mexico, all of which he's favored, you know, and that would be a sufficient combination for him to win the Electoral College, or likewise with a Virginia or an Indiana, naturally an Ohio or a Florida. But they feel like if they just get one state right where their current operation is especially good, where there's some local issue, where they get, you know, endorsements from newspapers and that kind of thing, that they can, you know, kind of get lucky. And remember, this is a campaign that during the primaries didn't really get any more popular vote than Hillary Clinton, but had a relatively substantial delegate lead because they knew where to target the delegates. They knew, you know, caucus states, it's lower kind of, it's easier to kind of get a delegate for every dollar you spend, resource-wise and stuff like that. So they understand. They're playing to win the Electoral College. McCain's running more of a kind of national campaign, and you could see a split this year, I think.
Well, of course, I mentioned earlier about Kerry that had there not been the voter suppression in Ohio, he may well have won. But I can't see how you could how Kerry could have governed with a deficit of 3.5 million in the popular vote. I don't know whether this is likely to happen this time around. But what about the notion of a 269-269 split?
I mean, I think, you know, what happens then is it goes to the incoming Congress, but it's not a straight up or down vote. It's done by state delegations. So, you know, Delaware gets one vote. Their one representative gets as many votes as, you know, California's 53 representatives or whatever it is. So, you know, right now the Democrats do have, I think, like a 26 to 22 edge in state delegations, and a couple are split. And they'll probably pick up one or two more states during the election this year, where they are going to pick up seats most likely in the House. So if Obama wins, if it's a tie and Obama wins the popular vote, I think it's straightforward. He'll become the president. It'll be kind of for presidential historians, but the conclusion's inevitable. But what if he does get a tie and he's lost the popular vote by 2 points, like John Kerry did? You know, then you might have pressure on, you know, delegations from kind of southern states. You know, a lot of these southern states still have Democratic delegations in the you know, House of Representatives, but, you know, are going to vote for McCain in the election. You'll have a lot of pressure running a lot of different ways, and that could be it could be a real nightmare where the Democratic Party feels like this is the one time where we have to get in line. You know, in 2000 we got you know, they feel like they got screwed over, and I think there's kind of time to make up for that now. But there'll be a lot of pressure, it'll make 2000 look like small potatoes. We have a tie with Obama losing the popular vote.
And which Congress would vote on the tie? Would it be the current Congress or the new Congress?
I believe it's the new Congress. So we don't know the precise composition of that right now. But the guess is, I've actually tried to go through and look at states where Democrats could gain or lose ground. You know, they should have at least a plurality of delegations. Remember, they can be split. If you have, you know, Arizona has four Democrats, four Republicans, I don't know how they kind of break that stalemate. But they should have a plurality at least. They might have an outright majority. What happens if the House can't break the tie, if they can't get 26 delegations, and the Senate appoints a vice president, and the vice president appoints a president? So you could have, you know, Joe Biden being the next president. There are crazy things that could happen. And, of course, they could also say, well, we're going to have – let's have an Obama-McCain ticket where McCain's the vice president or Obama's the vice president, or you get Palin with him or Biden with McCain. Who knows? There are a million things that could happen. It's never happened before, so – but be. It would be a lot of fun for political observers, but also I think there are real risks to, you know, the integrity of whoever would win the office under those terms.
Well, just in closing, Nate Silver, why are the elections of late so close?
Well, I think the campaigns have gotten smart about, you know, trying to eke out every last position they can stake out. I mean, there's something called the kind of median voter theorem, which goes back to the way saying that elections should be close because the campaigns kind of move towards a sense of equilibrium kind of derived from game theory and stuff like that. I think unless you get a politician like a Reagan who's been, you know, in office and just, you know, whether him or not, and I wasn't a Reagan fan, was a fantastic politician, very compelling figure, or a Bill Clinton, I suppose, you're going to have close elections. You're going to, cause, you know, I mean, well, I'll put it like this. The Republicans were smart to pick a candidate like John McCain that was a little bit more toward the center of the country when the country's mood had been left. If they had nominated, say, a Mike Huckabee or a Mitt Romney, I think they would be losing this election by 8 or 10 or 12 points. But with McCain, who is seen as a moderate, who's been very careful to try and keep his branding that way, then, you know, McCain's kind of as close to the center of the electorate as Obama is, even as Obama has, you know, even as the electorate has moved left, become more Democratic. So they kind of balanced things out this way in a way that was smart for them. I think, you know, like I said, any other candidate, they'd probably be looking at a landslide defeat.
Well, equally true, of course, if Hillary was on the ticket, maybe the Dems would be further ahead. So I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Nate Silver.
Of course. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Nate Silver, the force behind the polling analysis website, 538.com. He's a former, still a baseball statistician, but the politics and sports are similar. His website's named after the number of electors in the Electoral College, spelled out at www.538.com. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.